Chapter 1, A Made for Washington Scandal. Throughout American history, presidential administrations have undergone tumultuous periods of war and scandal. I happened to become White House press secretary at a time when the administration of George W. Bush was going through both, and they were intimately related to each other. In late May 2003, when the president asked me to begin serving as his chief spokesman in July, I did not fully appreciate just how contentious and venomous the atmosphere in Washington was, and how controversial and polarizing the presidency of George W. Bush was about to become. By October, less than 3 months after starting the new job, I was on the front lines defending a White House that was becoming engulfed in a growing scandal on the eve of a re-election campaign that had an increasingly hostile media clamoring and our partisan critics pouncing. For the American public, which had grown weary of the endless investigations and scandals connected with the Clinton presidency, the situation typified the worst of what they saw in Washington. The emerging narrative in the Washington press was that the White House had deliberately blown the cover of Valerie Plame, a covert CIA official. Administration officials had anonymously leaked her identity to reporters in order to punish at worst, or discredit at best, her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who was publicly alleging that the administration had misled the country into war in Iraq. News stories suggested that White House aides had disclosed Plame's identity to at least 5 reporters. A concerted White House effort to disclose her identity would have meant that the officials involved, knowingly or not, had leaked classified national security information. For nearly 2 weeks following the September 29th disclosure of a criminal investigation by the Department of Justice, I vigorously pushed back at the notion that the White House was behind the leak. Even before then, I had batted down any suggestion that my colleague and fellow Texan Karl Rove, a frequent target of our critics as the president's closest advisor, was involved in the leak. Later, I added the Vice President's Chief of Staff, Louis Scooter Libby, to the list of those I defended. By the daily White House briefing on October 10th, I was looking for a way to extricate myself from commenting any further about specifics of the Plame case, which were now part of the recently announced investigation. The opening I sought came near the end of that Friday's briefing in the form of a question from Victoria Jones, a cordial yet skeptical liberal talk radio journalist and Bush administration critic. "Scott," Jones said, "earlier this week, you told us that neither Karl Rove, Elliot Abrams, nor Louis Libby disclosed any classified information with regard to the leak. I wondered if you could tell us more specifically whether any of them told any reporter that Valerie Plame worked for the CIA." I was ready with a reply. "I spoke with those individuals, as I pointed out, and those individuals assured me they were not involved in this," I said. "And that's where it stands." Another reporter seeking clarification jumped in. "They were not involved in what?" "The leaking of classified information," I said. It sounded final and definitive, just as I intended. I'd chosen my words carefully. While I believed what I'd been told by Rove and Libby, I could never know with 100% certainty that it was true. So I purposely put the onus on them, noting that they had assured me about their lack of involvement. It was a firewall of sorts, designed to protect my own credibility if the truth turned out to be more complicated or wholly different from what I'd been told. Not that I expected it to be. After all, I was confident at the time that neither the president nor the vice president would knowingly send me out to mislead the public. The public's assurances I provided that October 10th would be my final comments from the podium denying that Rove and Libby had been involved in the outing of a covert CIA official, and my final comments on any other matters which might be part of the criminal investigation that the leaking of Plame's name had already spawned. There was only one problem. What I'd said was not true. I'd unknowingly passed along false information, and 5 of the highest-ranking officials in the administration were involved in my doing so. Rove, Libby, Vice President Cheney, the President's Chief of Staff, Andrew Card, and the President himself. For my next 2 years as press secretary, the false words I uttered at that Friday's briefing would stand as the official White House position on the Plame case. Little did I know at the time that what I said and the pervasive deception underlying it would be my undoing as the President's Chief Spokesman. I had allowed myself to be deceived into unknowingly passing along a falsehood. It would ultimately prove fatal to my ability to serve the president effectively. I didn't learn that what I'd said was untrue until the media began to figure it out almost 2 years later. Neither, I believe, did President Bush. He too had been deceived, and therefore became unwittingly involved in deceiving me. But the top White House officials who knew the truth, including Rove, Libby, and possibly Vice President Cheney, allowed me, even encouraged me, to repeat a lie. When the truth finally began to emerge, my credibility as White House spokesman was badly tarnished. A terribly painful experience for me. I blame myself. I allowed myself to be deceived. But the behavior of the president and his key advisors was even more disappointing. During 2003 and 2004, the White House chose not to be open and forthright on the plane scandal, but rather to buy time and sometimes even stonewall, using the ongoing investigation as an excuse for silence. The goal was to prevent political embarrassment that might hurt the president and weaken his bid for re-election in November 2004. The motive was understandable, but the behavior was wrong and ultimately self-defeating. And in retrospect, it was all too characteristic of an administration that too often chose in defining moments to employ obfuscation and secrecy rather than honesty and candor. As I reflected on this leak episode, one of the defining episodes of my 10 years as press secretary, my view of Washington began to crystallize as never before. What I witness and have come to realize about my time in the spotlight, beyond just this episode, is a larger, very unpleasant truth. The deception was not isolated to one event or even to the Bush White House. It permeates our national political discourse. And while much of the deceit has been incidental and has not been embraced consciously by our elected leaders, it has become an accepted way of winning the partisan wars for public opinion and an increasingly destructive part of Washington's culture. Coming to Washington as a member of a Republican administration, I thought the mentality of political manipulation had been largely the creation of our predecessors in the Clinton White House, and that the leader I placed great hope in, George W. Bush, was dead set on changing it. He chose not to do so. Instead, his own White House became embroiled in political maneuvering that was equally unsavory, if not worse, much of it related directly to his most consequential decision as president, the decision to invade Iraq. So much has been written about the plane leak episode in the past few years that even those of us who were part of its unfolding events have trouble piecing together the crucial details of how it all started. Let me lay them out for you. The explosive controversy that eventually led to the leak scandal began with an assertion about Iraqi efforts to obtain fissile uranium concentrates, so-called yellow cake, from the West African country of Niger. Based on documents that the CIA later acknowledged to be forgeries, this claim was one element of administration efforts in 2002 to demonstrate that the regime of Saddam Hussein was actively seeking to reconstitute its once-abandoned nuclear weapons program and was maintaining a stockpile of biological and chemical weapons. Largely for these reasons, along with the regime's support for terrorism, the president said that Iraq posed a grave and gathering danger to peace in the Middle East, and even to the security of the United States. This argument about WMD was, in turn, the centerpiece of his position that the United States was justified in leading its allies, as well as the United Nations, toward preemptive war against Iraq. In the fall of 2002, as debate was swirling around Washington and the world over whether or not a war with Iraq was necessary, Congress requested an NIE, a National Intelligence Estimate, about the status of Iraq's WMD program. An NIE represents the collective judgment of all the agencies that make up the U.S. intelligence community. In the NIE of October 2002, entitled Iraq's Continuing Programs for Weapons of Mass Destruction, stated that Iraq had been vigorously trying to procure uranium ore and yellowcake. The yellowcake, a reference to the Niger claim. Based partly on this NIE, Congress voted overwhelmingly and across partisan lines on October 11, 2002, to authorize military action against Iraq by the Commander-in-Chief.